Welcome to ITE 1, Module 8, Part 1. We never get through this in two.
We never get through this in one part.
I think she's still having sensitivity problems.
There we go. That should I'm now down to 20. I end up cutting off. Somebody please let me. And I'm going to...
Well, yeah, you did.
Just me down to about 10.
Did you take your boost down, Grace? Because if you took your boost down, take your boost back up. And no, don't take the boost down. Take the boost back up and knock 10% off your microphone level. That way you'll be louder than what you are now and you'll trigger.
Yeah, that's probably right. But anyway, as she was saying, we never get through Module 8 in one part, nor would we want to because it's a rather big module and we don't want to make your brains completely explode. So it's one that gets broken up into usually two, maybe every once in a while, three parts.
We don't know yet.
Okay.
Three?
Hopefully it's going to be better. There's a long module.
It did get broken into three once.
I've never
yeah, that
seen
is better,
any
Grace.
Lesson get broken into three.
Awesome. Okay.
Oh, no, this is everything you need to know about networking in one to three horrific, mind-bending, brain-melting modules.
Yes.
So, guys, I'm going to ask you to do something for me. And I know, and for me, even, this is a stretch when I was a student. Put your Twitter down. Close it. Close out all other windows on your computer. Tell your cat to leave the room and try to pay attention because this module is a lot of stuff. And we are...
Mr. Snuggles, get out of here.
That was awesome.
That was awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, Melissa, do you need an audio check on your new computer?
I do, actually. I'm on the old computer right now, but I... Right now, but I'm trying to get my laptop booted up, and it. I downloaded the Ventrilo client for the 64-bit because it's Windows 7. However, it's saying that another installation is already in progress. It's given me an error, so I just rebooted the computer, and...
Well, I'm going to ask
we'll
you
play
to
with that later.
Yeah,
we'll play with that
you
later.
You want to do that later. You really do, because
yeah, that's what I figured,
this is quite
so
a module.
Just went to the old computer. Yeah.
All right. So, let's begin. I'm going to tell you some important things about labs. This is all, a lot of it, I believe, is in your... in your accessibility document. The rest of it is in a study guide for 8.9.2. Now, in 8.9.1, you have a situation where you... I wish somebody would stop doing that. Okay. You have a situation where... Yeah, I know. It was somebody deleting stuff out of the Discovery. I think Brian's cleaning house.
Close your Dropbox.
Hold on just a second. Now my phone's ringing.
Oh, that's rare. The home line rarely ever rings. Okay, so while she's away, we're going to cover what sort of network devices you have, what they do, how they work, types of internet connections, ADSL, satellite, mobile phone, modems, which ones you'd use when, a little bit on wireless networking just to really get the neurons firing, and various things you could consider when talking to your customer about what sort of internet access they would like, which doesn't involve, oh, I want it really fast and I want it really cheap and I want unlimited jiggers. Okay, so that's essentially the overview of the module. There we go, Grace is back now.
That is, it was very concise.
Alright, sorry about that. Yeah, if people could... in the middle of lecture, we'd be good. Alright, so in 8.9.1, you have a situation where you might not be able to find a driver for a particular... for a particular wireless card, because the wireless card has been sold to another vendor. What do you think we do in this instance?
Cry?
No.
Besides
we don't cry.
We cry for a minute.
We can
and then
do
what
Google the new vendor.
It's not on the new vendor's website. So where else? Where? What do we do if it's not on a vendor's website? Are there other places that it might be?
Maybe just ship it into Google and hope that some forum somebody pops one up.
Yeah, absolutely. And Google. There are go ahead, Melissa.
Oh, no, I just said Google. I was just going along with her.
Yep. Google. Keep Googling. There's one of them that you are not going to find on the manufacturer's website. So you'll find it possibly on a different driver compilation site, which isn't always the best place for them. But hey, if the manufacturer is now not providing drivers for it, that's the best you're going to get, and that's okay. So remember that when you're doing 8.9.1.
I remember I had this problem for... No, wait, no, that was a different one. Never mind.
Sometimes it does, but often they're terrible. So, if they work for
Windows
you,
Windows Update Network drivers,
that's good.
Not necessarily good.
If they don't, though, right. You're going to have to go back and Google them up again. No, I actually had one that, like, wouldn't let me see any wireless networks and would, like, stack the computer every 10 minutes when I installed the Windows Update version of one of the Rylink drivers.
That's special.
So, yeah, user beware, rollback driver button is your friend in those particular instances.
One thing I've got to say about Windows Update, it's great if Windows Update has them, but the thing that you've got to understand is that you don't have the card in question right now. You just have a name and a model number. Your client is not with you, and you are doing research for them without the card in front of you. So you cannot always rely on Windows Update to have everything. 8.9.2, a note on that. You are kind of going to be doing 8.9.2 in reverse, because you guys have already set your IDs to be dynamically assigned. That's what Windows Default does. And since we don't have a lab to set up for you, that's how it's going to be. And now, if you look in DHCP and try to see your IP address and subnet mask in the DHCP properties, what do you think you're going to see there?
Unless you've manually configured static IP addresses for like port forwards and stuff, in which case you may very well end up doing it exactly the way the lab wants you to. That's certainly how it happened when I did the lab. I'd already had it set for static anyway. And then I was like, oh, okay, well, I did it the way they wanted.
Yeah.
But yeah, Grace's question's a good one. What are you going to see?
Yeah, what are you going to see? Okay. You're going to see nothing. You're going to see nothing in those fields. Does anyone know why?
Come on, guys, guess. We're not going to shoot.
Any guesses on why we aren't going to see nothing?
Why we will see.
Absolutely right.
Absolutely. It's set to find it already.
So you're not going to see anything in there. Don't panic. Just write down that you don't see anything. That is completely normal. And then you'll be able to go on with the rest of the lab as is. The rest of the lab's just fine to go on with. But people panic when they see nothing in those fields. When they look around with the JAWS cursor. Go ahead, Marlene.
Sorry, did somebody answer your question? Because I didn't hear any answer.
You're not in chat.
You may not be
they
in chat.
They did answer it.
It's chat, yeah.
Okay, I forgot to look in chat.
You can turn text to speech on and it will actually speak out their answers to you.
Thanks.
No problem. Okay, guys. So, any other questions on labs? And 8.9.2, the part with the telnet, you don't do. Telnet is kind of dead. It's kind of insecure, and I kind of can't find an anonymous server for you guys to log into, so you're not doing that part. Sorry.
And Windows 7 doesn't even have the Telnet client installed. You have to go dig
for
it. So.
Alright. Any other questions?
And if you don't remember this when you go to do the labs, it's in the accessibility document, which before you do any of the chapters from this point on, consult the accessibility document before you start working on the labs, because it will tell you things to look out for when you actually get to them. So every chapter from now on, look at, okay, what notes does she have for chapter 10? Okay, this one doesn't have any notes. All right, I'm good. Or see what they are. And if we get questions that we know are in this document, we will refer you back to it. Not because we don't like you, but because, well, it's kind of there, and we would like you to read. Wow.
What happened?
I just had your internet four died. Messages at the same time on TTS.
Yeah, I think your internet went, or someone...
That was... My internet didn't go, but the server on my end did. That was very interesting.
Yeah, something...
Okay, this is an incredibly heavy chapter. You guys read it, right? Well, we hope you did. For John in Exploration, anyone in Discovery, this is a review, but don't go to sleep. This curriculum goes about teaching networking in a different way. It's basically networking for, it's very watered down networking, and some of the concepts you might understand a little better in this way. Networks are systems that are formed by links. For example, websites that link your page to the pages of your friends are social networks. Facebook. We use many networks in our day-to-day lives, including mail delivery systems, telephone systems, public transportation systems, corporate computer networks, and the internet. The internet is what we're going to be talking about. And we're going to be talking about computer networks. A computer data network is a collection of hosts connected by networking devices. A host is any device that sends and receives information on the network. This is important. You have to know what a host is. For the rest of this module, that is like the first big building block. Host is any device that sends or receives information. On the network. Peripherals are devices that are connected to hosts. Some things are either able to be a host or a peripheral. A printer can be a peripheral if it is connected to a computer. But if it hooks directly to a networking device, such as a hub, switch, or router, it is a host. Okay, so I'm going to ask you guys a question. Because you do have a couple questions on this in the end of module quiz. So, if I have a fax machine that is just plugged in to a computer and can feed faxes through from a computer, is that going to be a host or is that going to be a peripheral?
Peripheral?
Oh, yes, that is. If that fax machine is plugged into my router, because it's one of these fancy Ethernet fax machines, what is it?
That's definitely a host.
Yes. Sorry? For those of you familiar with networking and IP addresses and stuff, basically the rule is if it has its own IP address, it is a host. If it doesn't and has to send information through something else that does have its own IP address, it's a peripheral. Does everybody understand?
Uh-oh, are you still...
Me?
Yeah, we're here.
Oh, the sound just completely faded out.
Oh, that's weird. We're here. Does everybody understand the difference between a host and a peripheral? Before we move any further.
I do.
Well, I didn't hear you, but I'm assuming that fax machine is a host, yes?
Which one?
Your fancy, connected to the router.
Yes, that's right. Yes. It is a host. We're all on the same page, right? This is very important for the entire rest of the module. Sounds like we are. So, if anyone has any questions about that, feel free to ask or stop me or whatever.
For anyone who's going on a discovery, this will be something that you'll
they've already done it.
No, but if anyone's not in discovery and is planning to go there next term with us, then you'll see it.
Absolutely. Networks are used all over the world in homes, businesses, and government agencies. Many networks are linked together using the internet, which is the world's biggest network. What kind of devices can be connected to networks? Any ideas?
Printer?
Absolutely. Anyone else?
Computers.
PDAs. Yeah.
PDAs. Yeah. Smartphones.
Your MP3 player can be. Depending on the MP3 player. iPods can be, for sure. I check my email using my iPod. Lots and lots of devices are network capable now, and even more are becoming able to connect to your network. Soon, you will have your toaster being able to be connected to your network, and you will be able to program it to make you up some toast.
I think fridges are going now.
Yeah. Yeah, they'll tell you what you need to get more of. Networks can share many types of resources across a variety of categories. These include services such as printing or scanning, storage space on removable devices such as hard drives or optical drives, applications such as databases. You can use networks to access information stored on other computers, print documents using shared printers, and synchronize the calendar between your computer and your smartphone. Network devices link together using a variety of connections. We have copper cabling. This uses electrical signals to transmit data between devices. Fiber optic cabling uses glass or plastic wires, also called fiber, to carry information as light pulses. Now, these fiber things, if you ever look, went to like...
You just faded out again. I'm going to try to restart my stuff.
Okay. Now, people are having fun today. Now, if anyone's ever seen those little fiber mood lamp things with all the little strings on them, very thin little strings, and they send out light. They've got them at like Spencer's or like really hippie stores that you can buy for your room. Has anyone seen those?
I have.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, they're like...
And it was one that we had, right. And it would spin the little things would sort of spin around. So it was kind of weird.
Yeah, they're pretty cool, I guess, if you can see. That is a, that looks like fibers. Those little thin, strandy things are what would be inside of fiber optic cabling. I actually got to, go to an IINet Open Day, and sadly, the last year's IINet Open Day was on our wedding day, so we didn't get to go, but the year before I got to go, and I got to see a bit of fiber optic cabling that went under the sea in Guam for a Australia to Guam cable, and the coating for this thing, the armor on this thing, was 2 inches thick steel with these little... with a hole in it for these little wires to go through. And it was really cool to get to look at that. Wireless connection uses radio signals, infrared technology, or satellite transmissions. We'll be coming back to these. There are many good reasons to network computers. Firstly, networking lowers costs because you can share resources. Imagine how
expensive...
Let's
see if these guys can come up with some reasons. This might be kind of fun.
Any reasons you guys network? Get on.
You know, I'm hearing everybody else, but Grace, you're like, you sound like you're on a cell phone, like you keep fading in and out.
Hang on just a second.
That's weird.
I might have an idea.
I'm not hearing that either.
What was the question? Any reasons you guys network?
Yeah, what are some reasons we use, some benefits of networking computers and things together?
Oh, I can give you one right now. I'm just getting this laptop, and I'm so unfamiliar with the operating system. However, it is a fast laptop. It's not booting up on me. Actually, right now I just turned it on, and it's completely silent. But I will say that, like, for doing labs, for example, because I've been trying to catch up on labs that have been way overdue since I've been really sick, I have two external hard drives where the labs are backed up in separate places.
So you
can
share
them,
right?
These hard drives are huge. Yes, I can share them, and I don't have to lug them around the house. I just network them to my computer. Oh, I love that. So I could be in the living room doing my labs, and the hard drives are plugged in the bedroom. You know, and it's so... It is just amazing. I really, really love doing that.
Absolutely. Also, someone in chat said that they use them in their company to share... they share a printer, and that's another good reason. Every secretary does not need her own printer on her desk, because that's just crazy as far as resources and all that ink and stuff.
Takes up too much space.
Absolutely. Any others?
Now this may be better. Am I more audible to you now?
So far, yeah.
Okay, that should do it. There we go. All right. So did we finish talking about, is there any reasons why anyone else would use networks? Why would you guys choose to use networks in your own lives?
We talked about sharing resources, sharing printers, sharing drives so Melissa can do labs across the house.
Absolutely. Okay.
All kinds of cool things.
Imagine, and people used to do this before networks. Imagine how expensive it would be if each computer in an office building had to have its own printer and backup drive.
Yeah, I mentioned that.
How much space that would take up, and it would be unbelievably expensive.
And money, and...
Yeah. With a network,
didn't
you only
we say,
need to
have someone say that they did that at their office, and it was like $50,000 in ink cartridges a year? Didn't we have someone say
that?
What
was that?
I think Gary said that.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Maybe it wasn't quite that much, but it was a ridiculously high amount.
That's a lot of money. With a network, you can set up two or three printers in a central location. When someone prints, the request is sent to a centralized print server, which can send the print job to an idle printer. So if there are a couple of print jobs going on at the same time, they can divide the tasks among different printers. Another benefit is increased connectivity. A file server gives people easy access to files they need in a central location. This way, multiple people can have access to files, and finding them takes less time. We have a file server at work. That's where you get your worksheets and labs and everything off of. Imagine if we had to email that to each of you. That would not be very productive, would it? Files can be shared with everybody or restricted to only those who need to see them. Servers also prevent file duplication and corruption. Document tracking software can be used to prevent users from overwriting files or changing files that others are accessing at the same time. Networks also allow collaboration between users. Collaboration tools include email, forums, and chats. You've got voice, video, and instant messaging as well for instant collaboration. A network allows companies to reduce software licensing costs by purchasing site licenses instead of buying licenses for each machine. These licenses can allow the entire organization to use the software or a specific number of people at a time. For example, you can buy a 10-seat license for JAWS. The server keeps track of how many people are using JAWS at any given time. If an 11th person tries to access JAWS, they are told that there is not a seat available for them. As soon as someone unloads JAWS, a seat becomes available. So if the person tries again, JAWS will load for them. Does that make any sense to
anybody? We have a ZoomText one at work, and it's pretty cool. The ZoomText one is incidentally quite a bit cheaper than the JAWS 5 user license.
Yeah, sometimes you don't get very much of a savings on these licenses. But sometimes you do. Like with Office, an enterprise Office, you might get quite a savings if you've got a lot of people. Any questions on software licensing?
I'm guessing this is how they did it, but I briefly worked for AFB, and they had, I'm guessing they had site licenses on both JAWS and WindowEyes, because I could go anywhere and work with, say, a sighted coworker on their computer, and we could pull up whichever screen reader I wanted.
Yeah, that's probably how they do it. Windows, I don't think, has the server side licenses. I think maybe they do. But I think they just do. Do they? Maybe they do.
They might, or they might, yeah, I don't know.
Any other questions on that concept? Because some people do find that a bit confusing.
This is very important. If your organization really does need a whole lot of copies of Office, you can't go taking one copy of, you know, one individual license and putting it on all of your computers. If network licensing is something you need to have, then you really should consider doing it. Licensing, as we've talked about a little bit before, is very important in an organization, more so than if it's just your home computer, because if you put pirated software on, it's on you.
Absolutely. Do you want to tell your story about your organization?
Yeah, our JAWS licenses are not... not really where they should be. I don't remember how many we have now, but certainly not as many as we should have. Is that the story you're thinking of, or is there a different
one? The point about that story I was going to make was before Sean got there, these people didn't even realize that they were improperly licensed. They thought that they were licensed correctly, and until somebody pointed it out that they weren't, they were just like, oh, okay.
Yeah, we're a little better now.
Yeah, they thought three seats, or three being able to use it on three computers, meant that they could use it, that three people could use it on three computers. Now, the JAWS license terms say that JAWS license is only for use by one person at any given time. That is what's in the license terms. And you know what? That's in most programs' license terms. One person at any given time. So, that is why you have network licenses, so that multiple users can use these things at one time, legally. So, when you're working for a company, it's really important to read those license agreements.
And the thing is, Freedom is very bad at explaining this. I've found that when my other people have tried to call to Freedom and get answers on it, the people are just pretty sketchy and don't explain it very well. So don't think they're going to help you understand it, because they might not.
Okay.
Yeah, theirs is quite evil. You should have a read of it sometime if you're ever bored, because I was like, whoa.
With networks, anyway. individuals do not need to manage data or devices. A network administrator or administrators are able to do these things for the entire organization. The user does not have to worry about things like updating, backing up, securing their individual workstations. This allows them to get more work done. You don't have to worry about antivirus. You don't have to worry about anti-spyware, no Windows updates. It just happens for you. And by the way, all of your files are backed up. finally, networks allow for redundancy and load balancing. A network can have more than one server to balance processing load. On networks, if a server or device fails, some networks are able to automatically use other devices to continue to function. Alright, so now we have an activity. We are going to talk about the pros and cons of centralized backup of data networks. We're going to talk about the pros and cons of actually using networks. So everybody into chat. Everybody's in chat. Yay. And we're going to type pro or con for this activity. Alright. Is this a pro or a con of using a network? Centralized backup of data networks. That is a pro. We'll wait for Bert to come down here. Hello! We're doing an activity on pros and cons of using a network. They can be difficult to troubleshoot. Is that a pro or con? Good job, everybody. I think the word difficult kind of gives it away, doesn't it?
No, I love difficult.
Peripherals can be shared. You are difficult. Pro or con?
You just made a new word, peripheral. That's awesome.
Oh,
yeah,
well.
You did. I didn't think about it, but...
I've made new words in lectures, too.
I don't notice until someone points it out. Have to be administered. That is a con. Because hiring an administrator is actually quite expensive. Networks allow groups to access documents. Pro, absolutely. Now that I've woken you guys up and had you guys participate in something, it's time for one of many vocabulary lessons for networking vocabulary. Networks
you
are given
different... You might
want to
take notes, actually. Because there's so many of the... Actually, that glossary is still
Tell
up,
them.
Isn't it?
Yeah, the glossary is up. I got to talk to Mr. Luke about finishing his glossary, if he's going to do that.
Ah.
Okay. Networks are given different names depending on the area they serve, how data is stored, how resources are managed, and how the network is organized. Also, type of networking devices, and type of media used to connect the devices. Oh my gosh, it's raining. Alright. A LAN stands for a local area network. In the past, the word local refers to the network being contained in a single physical location, such as a home or office building. Now local refers to the network being under the control of one administrator or group of administrators. This is important because you can have a LAN across an entire university and then going all the way over to a satellite campus on the other side of town. As long as it is handled by the same group of administrators or administrator, it's still a LAN, even
I
though
hope
it's not
more
very
than
close
one
together.
In that case.
Yeah, it probably is going to be a couple.
Otherwise, it'd be one poor person.
A LAN can be spread over miles and miles as long as it's only on one administrative control. Devices in LANs are usually physically close, but this is not a requirement. Okay. So that is a LAN a LAN LAN. This is a WAN WAN or wide area network. It is a network that connects LANs in geographically separate locations. The most common example of a WAN is the internet. And it's so funny because they capitalize the internet in this chapter, and I find it just hilarious.
Oh yeah, that they do that all over the
place. A lot of people do. Word will tell you to do it.
Oh, okay. The internet is a large.
It makes me think of the IT crowd.
Yeah. The internet is not an object. You cannot take the internet. You cannot turn the internet off. It's one.
It is not
a gigantic WAN.
It's not a box with. It's not a box with a flashing light on the top.
That's why I feel like capitalizing really the internet is so is so misleading.
It is goofy
because it isn't some big switch somewhere that somebody has.
People kept thinking that the president would be able to flip a switch and turn off the entire internet, though. Do you remember that?
Yes, yes.
Yeah,
the
internet
sort of
kill switch
can.
Thing.
It's like, I think it's right. I think it's still a proper noun, because it's like the United States. You don't have,
Yeah.
It's the name of an institution. As opposed to
which
would be lowercase.
Yeah. Fair enough. You're probably right, but people will just say, it comes back to this whole, the internet is a box with a flashing light that someone can switch off. Now, the President of the United States could give orders to kill the internet in the United States, possibly, but it's way more involved than just flipping a switch and the internet's off. All right. The internet is a large WAN that is composed of millions of interconnected LANs. Telecommunication service providers are used to interconnect to these LANs at different locations. Some very large companies have WANs with different administrators responsible for individual LANs in a particular location or locations. In a traditional LAN, devices are connected together using copper cabling. In some environments, cables may not be practical, desirable, or even possible. If this is the case, a WLAN, or Wireless Local Area Network, is created. Wireless devices are used to transmit and receive data using radio waves. These networks allow you to share files and resources, as well as access the internet, just like a LAN will. In this type of network, wireless devices connect to an access point when they are in range. The access point is typically the only device that is connected to copper cabling to the LAN. So you're going to have your wireless access point plugged into the copper cabling, which may be plugged into a switch connecting all of the other wired devices. Or it might be just plugged into the modem if you have an all-wireless topology. Does that make sense? So do we all understand LAN, WAN, and WLAN?
Yes.
Yep.
Cool. With a WLAN, the range for typical WLAN systems varies from under 30 meters, 98.4 feet indoors, to much greater distances outdoors, depending on the technology used. Alright, so just to make sure that we understand the differences, we have another activity. Yes, Module 8 is very interactive because they're trying to keep you all awake. So, your choices are... What?
It's a good thing.
Yes, I think it is. Your choices are LAN, WAN, or WLAN. So, the first type of network uses access points and wireless NICs for connectivity. WLAN, absolutely correct. This type of network uses cable connections in a single administrative group. LAN, absolutely. And finally, this type of network uses many technologies to connect distant networks. That is awesome. Guys.
I like that. I like that new one.
Hold on just a second. Be right there. Right back. Be right there. It's there.
Yeah.
Did I do WABM?
Huh? Somebody had WCAN.
I thought I had a B in mind, maybe.
Oh, I'm getting some.
All right, back. Our house is getting cleaned. This is a good thing. All right. Some networks do not have centralized administration. These are called peer-to-peer networks. In this type of network, individual users are responsible for their own resources and can decide which data and devices to share. In this type of network, each device has equivalent capabilities and responsibilities, so there is no hierarchy of computers. Peer-to-peer networks are best suited for 10 or fewer computers. There is no need to hire a network administrator for these networks. So, they can be good for small businesses. There are several disadvantages to this network model. There is no centralized network administration, which makes it difficult to determine who controls resources on the network. There is no centralized security, so each computer must use separate security measures for data protection. So you are responsible for your antivirus, you must update your computer, you've got to do spyware control. The network becomes more complex and more difficult to manage as the number of computers increases. There might be no centralized data storage because you're not going to use any kind of file server. Now, when I had a peer-to-peer network, and a lot of people will do this at home. You've got one computer that acts as the file server, and you put all your files on that computer because it has the biggest drive. The problem with this is that the computer has to always be on. With a server, it just all goes to that server, and the server's always on anyway. But if you're using someone else's computer to be the file server, or to keep your files on that extended hard drive that they bought, that is really, really big, if their computer crashes, all your files are gone. So if you're listening to music and their computer goes down, well, you're not going to be listening to music anymore. Does that make sense?
Quite a few times I've been, is your computer off? I need to print something and I can't print. Oh, jeez. Yeah, so I know what that's.
Does that make sense to everybody?
Okay, you know what? I'm kind of understanding that because I would have hard drives, like I said, plugged into my computer, and I would try to access that from the desktop or laptop, and it would give me an error. And I would go and turn the computer on, and then it would work. So now I understand why, because, I mean, I always, you know, common sense, I always knew, turn the computer on, but now I kind of understand why. That makes a little bit more sense. But yeah.
Ah, fair enough. Yeah, so that is why. That is why you have to have that computer on to access it. Network printers that are plugged in, these peripherals, if you have anything hanging off that computer, you have got to have it, that computer on for it to work. Or else it's not going to have a network connection. Separate data backups must be maintained by each individual computer, or you have to actually just put that information on to a hard drive on one computer. But you're responsible for doing it. There's nothing that's going to do it for you. You don't have a network administrator to save you. Peer-to-peer networks can be set up even if you're on a larger network that uses servers. Many homes have peer-to-peer networks, and you'll be computer technicians, you're probably going to have one. If you don't worry about it, because you'll be setting one up in module 15. The other network setup is the client-server model. The client requests files or services from the server, and if the client has permission to receive them, the server provides them. The server can do some of the processing work for clients to save on processor workload. The user, I'm supposed to use my network at home as an example of the client-server model. We have a file server, so whenever we download programs, the programs go into a folder on our file server. That way we can always get at them. It doesn't matter if my computer's down. It doesn't matter if my computer crashes. It doesn't matter if my hard drive blows up in 5 minutes. I still have access to those programs from any other computer. We run our email servers off of them, so I can get my email from anywhere as long as GOTS1 stays up. So the client-server model is very useful. We also have a peer-to-peer network in our house. This is so that Carrie and I can just share files quickly that aren't very important, such as, like, the grocery list. I can drop it in a folder for him to look at. And it doesn't matter if that goes away and dies, because it was just the grocery list for last week, and there was no real reason to back it up.
So basically, the network I have here at my house is a peer-to-peer.
That's right. You don't have a server.
Yeah.
Because that's really expensive. Or you could just make an old computer a server, but that's also quite fun. Okay. Alright, so in a client-server model, network administrators are the ones that maintain the servers. They implement data backups, security measures, and control user access to the network resources. You need a username and password to access network resources that you are allowed to use. A workgroup is a collection of workstations and servers on a LAN that are designed to communicate and exchange data with one another. Each workstation controls the user accounts, security information, and access to data and resources for that computer. A domain is a group of computers and electronic devices with a common set of rules and procedures. They're administered as a unit. A domain does not refer to a single location or a specific type of network configuration. The computers in a domain are a logical group of connected computers that can be located in different locations in the world. A specialized server called a domain controller manages all security-related aspects of users and network resources, centralized security, and administration. For data protection, an administrator performs a routine backup of all the files on the servers. If a computer crashes or data is lost, the administrator can easily recover the data from a recent backup. We do this with our email. Any questions on servers, domains? The domain stuff isn't really that important for you guys right now. They just kind of mention it and that there are domains. You might see a domain in a school. Our school for the blind had a domain, and you log in to on an individual workstation and you have access to everything that you have permission to access. Your security, your antivirus and everything is updated for you, and your data is backed up. Any questions on any of that? And having to do all of this stuff and have all of the data backups and security and usernames and all of that on your shoulders is why network administrators get paid so much money. Okay. Next. Alright, if you think you've had enough vocabulary today, that's unfortunate, because it's time for more! Bandwidth is the amount of data that can be transmitted within a fixed time period. The size of the bandwidth determines the amount of information that can be transmitted at one time. Bandwidth is measured in bits per second and is usually denoted by any of the following units of measure: BPS, bits per second, KBPS, kilobits per second, MBPS, megabits per second. A byte is equal to 8 bits and are abbreviated with capital letters. 1 MBPS with capitals is approximately 8 megabits. When data is sent over a computer network, it is broken up into small chunks called packets. Each packet contains headers. A header is information added to each packet that contains the source and destination of the packet. Kind of like a letter. You've got to have the address of where it is going and where it's coming from, so that if the packet gets all jump, or if the letter gets all return address, they can send it back to you. A header also contains information that describes how to put all of the packets back together again when it gets to the destination. It's like a jigsaw puzzle, but it's got instructions with each packet on where it goes in the jigsaw puzzle so that you can get your entire email message back together. The size of the bandwidth determines the amount of information that can be transmitted. If anyone wants to understand exactly what makes up a packet, there's a really good diagram somewhere in Discovery. Sean, do you remember where that diagram is?
I would guess it's probably in Chapter 3, but I don't know.
It might be. It's either in 3 or 6, if you really want to know about it. Otherwise, you could take Discovery with us, and you'll get to play with that as well.
I actually found that very difficult to understand, but that's because, I don't know, just because it's...
An 8-lane highway, if you think about bandwidth as in roads, an 8-lane highway...
No, I just mean the packet stuff I had trouble with.
No, I know, I'm going to explain it though, because it's in my notes, and I'm going on. Alright, we can think about bandwidth as a roadway. We've got our big, whopping U-verse AT&T. That's kind of like an 8-lane highway. It has more capacity for cars than a two-lane country road, which is our net-zero dial-up. So you can get a lot more through a lot faster on the eight-lane highway than that two-lane little country road. The more bandwidth they have, the more packets can be accommodated. The amount of time it takes data to travel from source to destination is called latency. Data is delayed by network devices and cable length. Network devices also add latency when processing and forwarding packets because it takes them a little bit of time to do this. This is not usually a problem when surfing the web or downloading files, but can be for things like voice chat or streaming videos. Data can be simplex, meaning that it can only travel one way, half duplex, meaning it can only travel one way at a time, or full duplex, meaning data can travel both ways at once. Broadband technologies such as DSL and cable operate in full duplex. This is why people with DSL can download a file and talk on the phone at the same time, even though the two technologies are using the same medium. All right, any questions on simplex, duplex, or half duplex? I'm sure a lot of people know about this from ham radio, but can somebody give me an example of a simplex transmission?
Maybe the computer sending to the printer?
Yeah, that would be.
No. No.
Yeah, that's going one way.
No, because printers can actually talk back to the... No, printers can actually talk back to the computer and say, hey, stop sending, or I'm out of ink,
that's
or
true.
I'm out of paper.
Well,
so I would, no.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I didn't think of that.
I was thinking of really old print. We don't have to think about this in internet terms. How about a simplex transmission in everyday life? It doesn't have to be having to do with the internet or anything like that.
Is it radio? Regular radio?
Yeah. Radio, TV.
Yep, TV.
Microwave.
Microwave.
Yeah, microwave internet. Yeah, no.
Huh?
Yeah.
I don't understand.
Anyway, we'll move
the
on.
Somebody actually said that today. They're like, "Oh, can I hook my microwave up to the computer?" And I was like, "No, you cannot." You know, because they were talking about the USB like. Beverage warmers and stuff. You could.
Oh yeah, yeah, I've seen those. Those are pretty cool.
Yeah,
that's
why
I was
USB
joking
USB
about
microwave.
That. I know.
Okay. So
moving on.
How about a half
duplex
transmission? Can anyone give me an example?
That's the telephone. Right?
Yeah, the telephone is actually half duplex.
Really? Because isn't it going both ways? Like you're talking and the person is.
No, it isn't.
Oh.
It is, but it isn't.
Okay.
It switches so fast that you don't know that it is half duplex.
I know another one.
So it's not simultaneous. It actually switches between. Wow.
Yeah, plain old telephone
That's
service
cool.
does.
I didn't
that explains
that
something.
Because wow.
If you call certain people, like in different countries or whatever, there will be a bit of a lag.
Carrie and I had this huge fight about this once and in one lecture about it, and he convinced me that, yes, it was half-duplex. Now, what was the other one that somebody said was half-duplex?
Somebody said walkie-talkies in chat, and that's what I was going to say.
Walkie-talkies are half-duplex?
In the module, it says that the telephone conversation is full-duplex.
But it isn't.
These
okay.
modules
like,
can
we hear
wrong.
It as full Oh, okay. Well, yeah, I think Carrie and I had a discussion about this. It says in the module, and he's like, well, technically it isn't. Because it switches so fast, you don't notice.
Yeah.
To us, it seems that it is full duplex.
I think
something like the printers you're talking about, where they...
I'm not
but
convinced.
If it switches... If it switches, how can you talk over the other person and be able to hear
them?
Let
me get Carrie
exactly.
to...
Exactly, talk at the same time.
Okay, I'm going to get Carrie to explain this one. I'm going to call him and get him over here to explain this.
I was going to say, I don't know if I can see if...
I want you guys to hear this explanation, too. Would you like to come over and explain to these people...
Only if it's like switching in the middle of words, practically. Or, I don't know.
Carrie is going to give you guys a science lesson, because this is interesting. Oh, well, apparently Melissa doesn't think so. That's okay.
She doesn't like the science.
No,
she's coming.
Oh, here I am.
Hello.
You are.
Okay, we're asking why phones are half duplex. Question, how many wires connect to a telephone?
Ah, there's two.
Anyway, everyone else agree with two? Okay, if we have two wires and we have an electrical circuit, can you send and receive something on two wires at the same time?
Oh, no, you can't.
No.
You think that a phone is full duplex because the turnaround time is so low that you can scream at your significant other over the phone and you don't notice the fact that there's a turnaround time of fractions of a second. But the reality is that phones can only either transmit or receive something at once, which is why a phone is half duplex.
And cell phones definitely aren't full duplex. There's a lot more delay there.
Most of that is encoder delay. But the other thing with a cell phone is that you cannot transmit and receive on a radio at the same time. Otherwise, when you transmit, you would be receiving your own transmitted signal. Therefore, there has to be a switching circuit.
So if there's a question about this on the exam...
They don't ask you that question.
So what's something that would be true full duplex?
Video conferencing, local area networks,
Skype.
What about ventriloquism?
Yes, it is full duplex. Samples and plays back at the same time. That is certainly full duplex.
Team talk is very full duplex.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I love Team Talk.
We're not using it because the chat doesn't read reliably.
And recording is weird, but now it's fixed, I think. Okay.
Actually, we're not using it because we don't have to pay for the bandwidth if we use this thing. Okay, move on. I'm out.
Thank you. So hopefully that makes a little more sense to everybody than me. I just did not think I could do that description justice. They're not going to ask you what is full duplex and what is half duplex and what is simplex in examples terms at all. But they will, I think they ask you about what it means. So I just wanted to give you guys some examples of and talk about examples of things that aren't internet. Okay, we're going to go on to IP addresses. Any questions so far, guys? Okay, an IP address is a number used to logically identify each device on a network. Every single host or network device, which are routers, switches, and hubs, must have an IP address to communicate with other devices on the network. That is really important. There are two types of devices on a network. Remember that a host is any device...
I'd go so far as to say its own unique address, because they can't share them either.
No, but we're getting to that.
Oh.
Remember, a host is any device that can send or receive information on a network. A network device is a subclass of hosts that includes hubs, switches, and routers. Peripherals do not need an IP address because they are connected through a host, which has to have an IP address. All devices that want to communicate with each other must have an IP address on the same network. If you wish to communicate with devices on different networks, such as the internet, you need to use a router. You can equate an IP address to a person's mailing address because it can change. A network administrator assigns IP addresses, much like the government assigns you a mailing address. An IPv4 address consists of a series of 32 binary bits, ones and zeros. It is very difficult for humans to read a binary IP address. For this reason, the 32 bits are grouped into four 8-bit bytes called octets. An IP address, even in this group format, is hard for humans to read. Write and remember. Therefore, each octet is presented as its decimal value, separated by a decimal point or period. This format is referred to as dotted decimal notation. When a host is configured with an IP address, it is entered as a dotted decimal number, such as 192.168.1.5. Imagine if you had to enter 32-bit binary equivalent of this, which is, are you ready for it, 11000100000000100000001. Imagine
that's a lot of ones and zeros.
It is a lot of ones and zeros.
Zeros. Yeah, that's tons of ones and zeros.
And I'm reading that off a Braille display, and even as I'm reading it, it's all close together, and I'm really, you know, having fun trying to keep up with where I am on that page, because it's just a sea of junk. If just one bit were mistyped, and I probably seriously read one of those bits wrong at least, I'm sure, the address would be different, and the host might not be able to communicate on the network. Good exercise for somebody that really loves binary. You could go back and see if the address I read out actually equates to the address I was saying it equated to earlier. You don't have to do that, but if you're really a dork, you totally could. And the recording is actually put up. All right. Each IP address has a network portion and a host portion. The host portion always comes first, and its length is determined by the subnet mask. A subnet mask is another 32-bit dotted decimal number. Hosts on the same LAN have the same subnet mask, or else they can't communicate. The subnet mask is divides LANs into smaller networks by changing their subnet mask. That is what subnetting is. You do not have to do any subnetting in IT Essentials. If you want to start learning about subnetting a very little bit, you can go to Discovery 1. Note, you'll want a calculator, because subnetting is very interesting, and it takes quite a while if you're not so great at math to actually conquer subnetting. IP addresses are divided into five classes. Class A is large networks, implemented by large companies and some countries. These usually have IP addresses in the range of 1 to 127 in the first octet. The range of private IP addresses are 10.0.0.0 to 10.255.255.255. Their subnet is 255.0.0.0, leaving them with 3 host bytes. So, if there is a 255 in the in one octet of a subnet, that means that that bit is for the host portion. So, there's only one host bit one host byte, which is our first 255, and the rest is going to be for hosts. This means you can have a lot of hosts on these Class A networks. You can have approximately 16.7 million hosts on a Class A subnet. Does everybody kind of understand that?
No, at all. Not at all.
Okay. Let's go back. So, you have a subnet on a Class A network, which is a huge network, of 255.0.0.0, which means
the whole point of a subnet is that it's a group connected to one router, so you're trying to get them individual identities.
Yeah. basically a Class A subnet, which you will never see, would be, you could have 16.7 million addresses on one network. So all of their host bits would be the same. Say all of their host bits would be 10. So it would be, you could have 10, everybody's host bit, everybody on that network would have to have the same starting bit of that IP address, which would be 10. The rest of it could be anything else that you wanted to put into it, because all of those IPs are yours. A Class B network is going to be a medium-sized network implemented by universities. These have a range of 128 to 191, and their reserved private IP addresses are 172.16.0.0 to 172.31.255.255. They have a subnet of 255.255.0.0 and can have approximately 65,000 hosts. So this network is significantly smaller. You may see one of these if you work for a huge company. But their host addresses, the bits that they, or the parts that they must have the same, are the first two octets of the IP address. So if you had a network, for example, all of their IP addresses would have to be, let's say, 128.1, and then the other two bits of the IP address could be different to identify them on the network. Does that make sense?
What's the point of the initial range that you mentioned?
What we're doing is something called classful subnetting. And the initial range that I am mentioning here is the first number of the IP addresses in which these Class A, Class B, Class C IP addresses fall. Really, it doesn't matter anymore. Because for you guys, you're only going to be working in Class C networks. But what they're saying is that Class A, these big networks, should always fall within the range. Their IP addresses will always start between 1 and 127. These smaller networks, the first bits of their IP address will start with 128 to 191.
What's the 255 part?
Okay, that is the subnet mask. The subnet mask is what identifies them as actual, as the Class A, Class B network. So if you have a Class A network, your Class A network is going to have a subnet mask of 255.0.0.0 and should start with the numbers 1 to 127. Your Class B networks will have a subnet mask of 255.255.0.0 and start within the ranges of 128 to 191. The IT Essentials curriculum doesn't even actually have the starting and ending ranges of IP addresses in them anymore. So you guys will basically only be noting if something is a Class A, B, or C network by its subnet mask. So it's how many 255s does it have in its subnet?
So the subnet is not an IP address.
No, the subnet is not an IP address. The subnet is... Like, go ahead.
What is it? Like, where does it... Like, what's done with it?
Where does it live? Okay. If you go and do an ipconfig/all, you will see your subnet mask. That is to basically make sure that all of your... the subnet mask basically tells you how many network bits and how many host bits you have. So if you have in a Class C network, which you haven't gotten to, that is what you guys will mainly be seeing on your computers. A subnet mask for a Class C network is 255.255.255.0, which means that when you are setting up networks, only the last dotted decimal part of your IP address identifies your computer from the rest of the network. So if your IP address is 192.168.1.2, only the 2 identifies you from the rest of the network. So, okay.
Do we have IP addresses because we're on the internet, but if we don't have a network, do we necessarily have an IP address until we go online?
You have an IP address, and we'll talk about DHCP in a little while. You have an IP address whenever you need an IP address on every computer whenever you go online. So you have an IP address right now. If you go to ipconfig/all, it will show you all of the IP addresses that you have. And each of your network cards may have an IP address.
That's ipconfig/all?
Yep. If you go into your run dialog box, hit Windows R and CMD, you press enter, and you can type in ipconfig/all, and it will show you all sorts of information about your IP addresses. So basically, what the subnet mask does...
Ooh.
Go ahead. Do you see a lot of stuff?
An incredible amount of stuff.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm seeing a lot of stuff, too.
Go ahead, Lynn. What were you going to ask?
No, I don't have anything else. Keep going.
Okay. So, the subnet mask, which should be on all of yours, unless you have one of these crazy D-Link routers that decides to use a Class A address, which completely doesn't matter to anyone at that point, is 255.255.255.0, meaning that the portion of your IP address, such as 192.168.1, is going to be the network portion of the address. All of your computers have to have that address. Now, if you were to set a computer to 192.168.2, it would no longer be on the same network and could not communicate with any of the other computers. The only part that can be different in a Class C network is the last octet. So it would be 192.168.1 dot the number that identifies your computer. Does that make sense?
Maybe I'm a little stuck on IP addresses because, like, when I get my computer out of the box, it doesn't have an IP address. Somewhere it gets an IP address when I go on the internet. But does that relate to, like, if I were creating a home network, how would I know that going one digit in either direction that address isn't already taken somewhere?
Oh, well, we're going to talk about that. That's called DHCP. And DHCP is how Windows and most things automatically get IP addresses for you. So you don't have to assign these IP addresses. Windows does this for you.
Is my memory, like, going completely nuts on me, which is always possible, but don't some brands of routers, when you're going to configure them, they start with IP addresses instead of 192.168.1? They'll have, like, 10 in that third octet.
Yeah. In the first octet, yes, they can, they do. That's, I think it's D-Links can do that, and that's just really strange. It doesn't matter to you, and doesn't make a whole heap of difference, and that's why they do it. But yes, that is possible.
Yeah, I've got at least one brand. I've got two different ones. The one here at home, Well, the one at work here and the one at home, yeah, one's on 10 and one's on 1.
Yep, absolutely. Yep, D-Links can just be strange like that. It doesn't matter.
If your IP address, though, can be changed, and you've created a network based on that IP address, and you change your address, you mess up your network.
If you change your address, you can mess up your network or that computer if you don't know what you're doing. Your router is your DHCP server. Your router is going to assign all of the IP addresses for your network right now. But if you, which is something you will get to do and understand when using in 8.9.2, you will change your network to a you'll change one of your computers to a static address. No, you won't, because you're actually just doing dynamic. In the advanced module, you'll change to a static address. And it won't matter, because you're going to change your IP address to the same static address that your router had given you as a dynamic one. And you would do this if you had a program that wasn't, or like an internet application, if Ventrilo wasn't working for you. You might lock down your IP address by changing it, or by setting the IP address that your router has given you as a static IP address on your computer. Then you would go back into your router and tell your router's firewall that you wanted the port for Ventrilo to always be forwarded to that IP address. But normally, your router's just going to deal with this for you.
And if we're going to talk about it later, I can wait. But what happens, why do a lot of times on little home routers you get an IP conflict when there's, you know, a couple people hooked up wirelessly? Why does it not know that someone else is already on there? I get those messages every once in a while. I mean, it goes away, but they happen. I get those messages fairly regularly.
Have you configured have you locked down any of your IP addresses?
No, I'm talking about when everything should totally be automatically set up. I have at times for different reasons, but no, I'm talking about when everything should theoretically be completely automatic.
Do you have more than one router plugged in?
No, ma'am.
Congratulations! You have a really crappy wireless router. Go buy a new one. That shouldn't happen. If it's supposed to be doing all of the configuring for you, it's not doing its job correctly, and I don't know where you got it, but it isn't working as it should. DHCP always should know which IP addresses it is given out. That is the whole point of DHCP.
Yeah, that's what I would think.
So either that's a configuration error on your part, or a configure, or something is very wrong with that router, and you probably don't want to use it.
I say it happens just very, very. You know, I'll get one message, and then it goes away. You know, it happens just for, I don't know, probably just one little thing. Now this is a really bad connection here. My brain can't get around any reason why that would matter, but it does. It's very intermittent. It cuts out a lot at times, not every day, but yeah, it's only happened on this one, and I'm pretty sure it's happened with two different routers, one being a Linksys and one being a D-Link. So it is odd, but I'm wondering if somehow this really terrible connection could somehow be causing it.
I don't know.
It may be tricking the router. It may be causing the router to try to reset something, or the router doesn't catch up.
I think you just said D-Link, and that may be your problem right there.
Yeah, well, that's the one I have now, but I did have this happen before with the Linksys also. So I don't know.
Don't know. All right. Any other questions on IP and subnetting? And we can come back to this next week. Don't worry. And we will.
Just one thing. So like, D-Link is really bad in your opinion.
You've just spoken over somebody. All right, go ahead, Marlene.
He's got a really long delay going on there.
Ah, Lynn, sorry. You must.
If you're in a country, say, where you're trying to get access to a place on the internet that they don't, they won't communicate with that country, there's a way you can run software that fakes out, like, what your IP address is. What is that doing, and how is it communicating? Like, what's it doing to your computer, to your router? Like,
okay. That is called a proxy server. And a proxy server, basically, you're going to change your proxy server on your computer and put in this new information. That is going to send your packets out through that proxy server, and that service is going to believe that you have an IP address of that proxy server and all of the relevant details. If you want a better explanation, I can get Carrie to explain it to you, but that is the simple layman's explanation I have for you.
It's sort of like a front.
Yeah, it makes it think that you were sitting in, California when you're in Australia, or whatever it is.
It works.
Yeah, most of the time it does. All right. Go ahead.
Now, I don't even know what the question is. Like, there's a question there, but I don't know what it is yet. So.
Oh, if you think of it, write to me. Bert, you're up. Sorry.
Yeah, I've been getting some really bad delays. No, would never talk over someone purposely. But anyway,
No, I don't.
So you have a lot of negative experiences with D-Links or bad stories or both?
They're not great, as far as we've been able to tell. Some people have had really great experience with them, but most of the people and most of the D-Links we've worked with have not been that fantastic, unfortunately. Okay, back to what we were talking about. These IP addresses and subnet masks. Has looking at your IP config data helped you at all?
Yeah, it did.
Okay. Marlene, Lynn?
I didn't really pay too much attention. It was like an overwhelming amount of information, so I'll have to go back and look at it.
Yeah, it is a lot of information. Uh-huh. But
listen to my study guide on... there's a study guide for 8.9.2, and I tell you guys, and I can tell you now and write it out, but it'll probably be even better if you listen to it because you'll have that information. There's a way of actually funneling that IP config information into a notepad document so that you can review it.
Yeah, we did that earlier this year, I think.
Yeah.
But,
go ahead, Melissa.
I understand what you're saying about the octets, though, now.
Okay, good. That's where I want you to be. You don't have to know this really, 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 really well. You've got some labs and stuff that will shore this up for you and some experiences. And until you experience it, the notes may not do you a whole lot of good. But you'll get some experiences. 8.3.2 is one where you get to choose if something is a Class A, B, or C network by basically its subnet mask. I have also made sure that the starting ranges for the IP addresses are also classful. So if you care to look at the IP addresses as well, you can. But for this exercise, it's basically subnets only. So what you want from this is if it has 255.0.0.0, it's an A. A networks are huge. 255.255.0.0 subnet is B, class B. These are medium-sized networks. Your class C, which I was going to read to you guys about next, is subnet mask of 255.255.255.0. And this is the IP addresses that you guys are going to have. The range of these IPs is 192.2.2.23, with your private IP addresses from 192.168.0.0 to 192.168.255.255. Your subnet mask, as I said, was 255.255.255.0. And these are small networks where you can only have 254 hosts. So these are going to be your home networks. Your Class Ds are special use for multicast, and Class E is for experimental testing. You don't really need to know too much about that. That's basically it. All right, so I think I've fried your brains in a completely lovely way, which always happens in Module 8. So we're going to stop there. And the only lab that is due for you guys next week is your 8.3.2. If you want to, you can do 8.9.1 to get ahead. If you don't, you don't have to yet. Any questions or anything else I can clarify for you guys before we go today? All right. Well, read your notes. If you have questions, find me, Skype me, ask, write me an email. I'll write you back. And next week, we can re-go over this bit again, and we will go on to the rest of the module.
Which bit confused them?
IP addresses and subnets.
Ah, Kieran's just helping with something. I'll be back.
And don't worry, that confuses a lot of people, so don't feel bad.
And I'm starting to to feel like I've got my head around this pretty well between Discovery in your explanation here. It's one of those things that definitely the second and third time is the charm.
Third time's the charm.
But, yes, ma'am. But could you repeat the ranges for the Class D in Class? Well, you didn't really give them right here, I don't think. But
no, okay, doesn't matter. Completely is irrelevant. I don't even know what they are.
So Class C is 192. To what? 223 or something? 24. Okay.
24.
Okay, good deal.
But yeah, no, you are not required to know about the ranges for D or E. E is, you can think of E as experimental class, D is your multicast, and honestly, that's really all you have to know about them at all.
How does my router assign an IP address?
We will talk about that next week. That is DHCP, Dynamic Host Control Protocol. And I will explain that all to you. There's a whole process that it goes through to assign your computer an IP address. And I will go through that with you all next week. But I think I've overloaded brains for now, so.
Actually, I think you were pretty clear. I think that was really good.
Gosh, I didn't think I was very clear at all. And I used to actually not teach this section. I always had someone, and for the past, well, actually the last year and the year before I taught it, but for two semesters when I started teaching, I didn't teach it. I assigned other people to do it.
No, I was really overwhelmed by the reading, but I feel, even if I sound confused, I feel way, way less overwhelmed now.
Oh, good. That's what we want. That's what the point of the lecture is.
Are the study groups you were talking about from last term, or where should I be looking for them?
They're last term. It's in study group. It's in our audio area, and there's a folder called study group. Oh. There we go. Next week, we'll do more. And we get into more cable types and stuff, and it's not nearly as as theoretical as this IP addressing stuff. So we'll finish this, finish up talking about subnet mask, default gateway, all that good stuff, and we will move on to customers' needs and ISP types and stuff, which is not nearly as theoretical and is more... Don't know what that was about. Alright. Alright, I think we are done, guys. Everybody have an awesome week, and you only have that one lab that you guys have to do.
Thank you. Good night.
Yeah, thanks.
Or good morning, or whatever.
Oh.
Yes, very informative. I've learned a couple of things about through the chapter, obviously, and through the lecture about networking. I've had a wired network up till this week, and having wireless is definitely new to me. This is very new technology.
Fair enough.